My name is Abraham Flaxman. I'm an assistant professor of global health and computer science here at the UW. I work at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. They're the ones who provided these lovely green themed slides, which look very strange on certain projectors. This one, medium strange. What I would like to tell you about today is global health informatics. At least that's how it was billed on the announcement of the talk. And I'll try to work with that, although I'm not totally sure if I know what informatics is. Am I right thinking it's computer science, but targeting health and medicine and the NIH as a funding stream? And the subtitle is A Big Data Revolution in Disease Burden Management. So I'm also not sure this is a revolution in the sort of scientific revolution sense, and I'm not sure exactly what big data is. But I will try to deliver on all of these things. I am, by training at least, a mathematician, a very interdisciplinary one. I was in the math department doing something that they all thought was computer science or maybe appropriate for the business school, but the computer science department thought was definitely math, or if computer science, you know, at best some theoretical sort of mathy part of computer science that they would tolerate. But I started learning about global health through a postdoc 5 years ago. Time flies. And I learned what I know through the Global Burden of Disease Study, which is this massive effort that has recently published results estimating the burden, making comparable estimates for how bad is this disease compared to that disease in this country compared to that country at this time for this age group, different sexes. It is a comprehensive effort to quantify disease burden. When I would go back to my buddies from the math and computer science department and tell them about all the stuff that I was getting into, well, a lot of them weren't interested. They'd say, it sounds great, but you know, what we're doing here is the math or computer science stuff. But the ones who really did engage with it, what they would start with is a question which I think is a great place to start, which is, how do you measure that? You know, what are the units for disease burden? And at least the way we are doing things at the IHME, disease burden is measured in years. Disability-adjusted life years, to be precise, which is a summary metric that includes years of life lost, so the amount of burden due to premature mortality, and combines that with years lived with disability so that we can account for diseases that kill and diseases that make people ill but don't kill in some uniform way. And what I think is a great thing to do now is just look at some of the results. This is a screenshot from an interactive data visualization that I'm going to switch over to now. And if you want to switch over to it or look at it sometime in the future, it doesn't have a nice URL. So do a web search for GBD Compare and you will find it. It was the first thing in Google and in Bing when I tested it today. And hopefully it will continue to be, or at least be obvious, where to find this GBD Compare tool. The problem with this tool is that it is putting a huge amount of information in front of you, and so it's a little bit complicated to start with. So that's why I think it is worth me going through a little bit, because with just a few minutes start, you can really dig into some interesting information here. So what I'm going to do is, this is called the tree map, and it's a glorified pie chart. Each disease has a little rectangle associated with it, and the area of the rectangle represents the amount of burden of that disease as a fraction of all global burden. But what I'm going to do is, the tree part is about the hierarchical organization of these. I'm going to go to depth one, where this is just breaking things up into three different groups. And the color has some meaning, but I'm going to turn that off for now and just color them red, blue, and green according to the groups they're in. Where group one is the communicable maternal neonatal nutritional illnesses. Group two is non-communicable diseases. And group three is injuries. And already, even at this level, you can see something that people love to talk about in global health called the epidemiological transition. This is the picture for 2010, but I'm going to rewind in time, 2005, 2000, 95, 1990. At the beginning of the time period that we produce estimates for, group one, the communicable maternal neonatal nutritional conditions, was the biggest of all of these. And over the 20 years, going from 1990 to 2010, you can see communicable shrinking, non-communicable growing. Now NCDs are the biggest burden. And I should say also, I will try to leave time for questions, but if there are questions during the talk, that's a great way to get more information about something right when it comes up, and I'm happy to entertain questions as I'm going, if you can get them in while I pause for breath or something.
Can you tell from that if the total pie is shrinking, like maybe we're doing a better job, or it's just a change in...
Great question. This you can't tell. It's saying there's 100%, and that's that rectangle, and here's how it's allocated. This top chart gives you a bunch of different ways to look at this. And if I used a different one, such as time plot, then I could tell. As far as a rate, it is going down, but the population has been growing over this whole time. So in absolute terms, which one are we looking at?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
Of the extent to which oral health diseases are included in this list of
wonderful question. Some oral health conditions are included, and I will try to come back to that later. Two more questions.
Question I have is a little more detailed. In terms of the communicable, maternal, etc., why were those kind of grouped together?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't seem quite intuitive at some level.
The communicable diseases make sense, right? That's kind of like the classic epi programs have been working on. Smallpox, you know, eliminating communicable diseases that we have vaccines for or that we can change in various ways. Those same programs have focused traditionally on maternal neonatal health and on nutrition as an important component of neonatal and child health. And so they're grouped together because of what people who know this area more than me deem public health relevance. Now, this global picture masks great heterogeneity, and we've already looked a little bit about how things are changing absolutely in comparison to as a percentage. We've mentioned but not yet looked at the very many different conditions in there. And what I want to turn your attention to now is the geographic variation, bringing up a map that shows in the whole world, we have this breakdown overall, but in some places, such as in Central Africa, things are very different. And here in DRC, we see that the communicable, etc. condition is still dominating that breakdown, versus in the United States, we're very far along in the epidemiological transition, and non-communicable diseases are covering a large portion of the burden here. I'm going to zoom in on the depth again. So this we see the non-communicable breaking down into different second level categories and those into third level categories. And I think third level is enough for me to look a little bit more because there is also great heterogeneity in terms of age groups. And we've been looking at all ages here, but if I were to focus on the 15 to 49 year olds, you would see non-communicable still large, but smaller than overall, and injuries are now growing to fill a lot of that area. road traffic injuries, violence, which really means homicide in this context, and self-harm, which really means suicide. And one more piece to show in this tool is a way to look at the change over time for a specific condition. HIV, I clicked on the little box there, and if I switch to a time plot in the bottom, you can see now in the United States, the dallies for HIV very high at the beginning of the period that we were looking at, with this substantial drop between 1995 and 2000. And for those of you who are familiar with the epidemiology of HIV, you know that there was a huge breakthrough in that time period. We can see it right on the chart that these effective treatments were invented and became widely available, at least in the United States.
That chart is a good one because I had a question about variants.
Yes.
So the error bars around any particular point estimate there seem like you're measuring a lot of conditions which are very difficult to measure, and even causes of mortality is difficult to get in many countries. HIV is interesting because your error bars get much smaller recently. Does that reflect better data collection on the part of PEPFAR, or is that a reflection of the inherent distribution of the data, the sort of mathematical variance across what you're looking at?
I am so glad that you brought this up, because a lot of times I don't include this uncertainty in a talk because it seems complicated. But on the other hand, it's something that I'm most proud of in all of this work, that we have tried to make estimates of what we don't know. And that's exactly what upper and lower bound mean in this estimate. HIV is a great place to start talking about this uncertainty, because it is the thing we know the most about in global descriptive epidemiology. UNAIDS is a UN body specifically devoted to understanding and combating HIV/AIDS, and they are far and ahead in global health metrics, only looking at HIV and AIDS. And so when they updated their estimates in the, I think it was about 5 or a little bit more years ago, and said we were a little bit high and we've looked at all the latest data and we're reducing our estimates by 15%, it was like front page news that they were this far off. For every other condition on this chart, I would be shocked if we were within 15%. I think 20%, 30%, when you're talking about especially the non-fatal health outcomes, you know, I think being within 30% is pretty good as far as what we know about this stuff. So this is ongoing methodological development, trying to figure out how to quantify what we don't know, and I think there's a lot of follow-up work to say, and what are the things we really need to know? HIV is something that's been a huge focus, and in the United States, now that there is treatment for basically everyone who knows that they need it, we should be able to say the burden here. If you were to go back to that map and switch back to somewhere in southern Africa where there's a lot more disease, a lot less resources to treat it, there should be a lot of uncertainty about how much burden there is.
So even in the United States, looking at 1990, for instance, I think maybe back in the 90s there was more uncertainty around the way people reported causes of death that was HIV related.
Absolutely.
So is that reflected in the larger error bar? Because that's a sort of
subtle
type.
And I'll try to dig in a little bit, but I won't get into specific details about specific diseases. Yes. Where do these numbers come from? In general, is a perfect transition into what I want to spend the rest of the time here on. Because this is dangerous, this part that I've been doing in two ways. It's dangerous because it's a demo. When I was at the MIT Media Lab, they said demo or die. It was very much a demo culture. What I saw was demo and die, that these things almost never work. And as far as I've gotten without having a major technical problem so far is as far as I'm going to push it. This is dangerous. It's dangerous for you also, because I have been tracking how people use this tool on the web. And the average session length for someone sitting down to explore this tool, 45 minutes. So, I have given you a great waste of time if you're interested in this sort of thing. Now, some people may be able to finish in less than 45 minutes. It is an average, but that means some people are taking even more time with it. So, I hope you will spend some time, the right amount, depending on how busy you are. And if there are things that look weird in there, let me know. Because these results at the country level have only recently been released, and I think we're still in the process of finding small surprises in there. And now, I will tell you a little bit about how that information is made. This flowchart is from one of the papers in issue of The Lancet that recently focused entirely on this work. And it is an attempt to break down into 18 different boxes the components of the analysis. I will not be able to go through each one in a one-hour talk. We're doing a 10-day workshop in May where I'm not sure they'll be able to go through each one. What I would like to focus on is four, which are four of my favorites and four that I think are quite important, but I'm not sure if I'll be able to do all of those either. So I'll see how much I can tell you. And again, I encourage you to ask questions because I would rather tell you something about some of them than go through all my slides and communicate nothing about all of them.
I'm interested in the disability rates.
Yes. So. That is the fourth of my four.
I saw that.
I will try to get to it. But I'm not going to change the order now because then I'll be all over the place. I will start with age-specific mortality rates. So one of the pieces in all of this work was saying for 187 countries, for 1970 to 2010, here are our best estimates of mortality rates by age and sex. And actually, even that is too much to do in a one-hour talk. That has three basic parts to it. Child mortality, which is the probability of death from age 0 to 5. Adult mortality, which I'll talk a little bit more about, and that's age 15 to 59. And then putting those together in the places where we have a lot of data and figuring out from that how to put those together in places where we don't have a lot of data to come up with the age-specific estimates. So, just to give you some of the flavor, a little bit more about the adult mortality part, what demographers call 45Q15. That is the probability that someone at the age 15 will live 45 years to the age of 60 if the mortality patterns are frozen as they are right now in the year of interest, whatever that might be between 1970 and 2010. Now, how do you figure that out? If you're in the United States, you go to the CDC website and download a bunch of death certificates that they make available anonymously that say pretty much everyone who died, here's how old they were. And then you go to the census website and you find out the denominator and you can make a very good estimate of the adult mortality rate, shown here in purple diamonds with a line that has basically no uncertainty going through them. What do you do if you want to make that same pot in Paraguay? Well, Paraguay is not a high-income country, but it's not a low-income country, and they have a vital registration system just like we do in the United States. We don't think it's capturing everything, however, and so that's why we take the stuff off of their website just the same way, but then try to make an adjustment based on looking at census data and saying how much is missing between the censuses. And you can see there's a little bit more variation in here year to year than there was in the United States. In some ways, that reflects the idea that maybe there's more variation because their vital registration system is not complete. So having filled that in, you can now draw a line smoothly through the middle and have a larger uncertainty area around it, reflecting we don't know exactly how much is missing. Now, what if you wanted to do this somewhere where they don't have a vital registration system? One place I've been particularly interested in is adult mortality in Iraq? Well, in this case, 2 points where they had vital registration, which we have to adjust for completeness, we'll use it. And in the remaining 40 years, we'll have to fill it in based on other information, such as household surveys, which are the source for all of the squares over to the right of this graph. And in a household survey, the way we find out is by taking a representative sample of households, knocking on the door, and saying, we've got a bunch of questions for you. And some of those questions are, please tell me about all of your siblings, that is, all the brothers and sisters you have who are born to the same mother, and if they're still alive. And if they died, when did they die, and how old were they? And from that sort of information, you can now make an estimate of the adult mortality rate. Question?
Yeah. Why you chose Iraq, even though it has, for the last 10 years, terrible war there?
Precisely why I chose Iraq. Because for the last 10 years, it has had terrible war there. And I think it's of importance for epidemiology, and especially conflict epidemiology, to understand what the effects of that were on population health.
Are you aware of the politics there?
Well, not entirely. Is there something I should be aware of?
Yeah. The politics there is terrible, and most of the people will not tell you the truth about only civilians they have, where they live, because they're trying to hide some information.
So there is, I am aware, huge debate about some of the household surveys that have gone into this estimate. The Iraq Family Health Survey, for example, was run by the Ministry of Health in Iraq. And many people believe that at the time when they were conducting this survey, if someone showed up at the door of your house and said, we're from the government and we'd like to know about your siblings and their health, they wouldn't necessarily get great answers. And this is one specific example that I think is particularly challenging. But it's also important. And we're trying to make comparable estimates for all of these countries. So we have to deal with these things as best we can.
Well, as I know, the north of Iraq, which is one third of Iraq, is not under the control of the Iraqi government.
And I believe there are some parts of the country that were not visited during this survey as well.
Yeah, so how that?
Well, do you think that the population health is different in the north of Iraq compared to Baghdad?
Yeah, I think so.
So, how different?
The problem, the north of Iraq is more stable, but the center of the south is not. And there's a huge problem of people being forced to leave their cities and live in other cities. So they might just break in the house and live there. Knock on the door, ask them to call the people there. They won't answer you, or give you a false answer.
So,
based on that, I think that will affect totally the data there.
I hope to be back someday soon to tell you how, specifically for Iraq, I want to clean this all up, because I've actually been helping some other people at UW and at some other universities conduct our own survey, where I can answer you exactly what I think the shortcomings are and the corrections are for example, how the North is different from the rest of the country. And I think I run the risk of not talking about anything else because I'm so excited to talk about that now. So I think
I could generalize that question slightly. I think Iraq is fascinating because your answer described a bunch of very specific methodological adjustments. And I'm curious if you look at, you know, Iraq and Cameroon and Peru and the United States, how much methodologic adjustment is there? You know, do you need sort of the Peru desk to tell you how to, you know?
And this gets into a very interesting philosophical split between how to approach these. And the goal is no. I don't want different methods that are done by different experts in each area. I want a comprehensive solution that says here's the sort of problems that you expect to have in a conflict setting. And, you know, maybe that's impossible, but the dream is unified objective methods, and we use that for a conflict setting in Iraq, we use that in Democratic Republic of Congo. Maybe that's the same sort of approach you need after a disaster setting, like in Haiti after an earthquake. And let's talk more. But I want to give someone in the audience disability weights. And that means making it through cause of death estimation and morbidity estimation. We're well on schedule. Nothing to worry about. So, on to box four. Estimating causes of death. Because if I've already started getting grilled just about coming up with the all-cause mortality amounts, it's going to be really hard once we start saying, what are people dying of? And in that tool, I have numbers up there that say, for every country, here's what people are dying of. So, how the heck did we come up with those? Well, again, the first stop is the CDC website. We look at these vital registration summaries, and one thing that they include is death certificate data. And a death certificate might look like this, and if it was filled out very well, it might say something like this, where the disease or condition directly leading to death is in line A, and it says that happened hours before the death. And then it works its way down and down and down to the bottom line of that part one, in this case D, that says the underlying cause of death was breast cancer. So in a country that has complete vital registration coverage, that has really well-certified death certificates, again, the same answer as when I was looking at all-cause mortality. I get that stack of death certificates, and I figure out how many people there are from census for the denominator, and I do division. The problem here, even if you want to do this in the United States, is tons of death certificates are filled out in ways that are wrong. This is an example where there's just a simple clerical error in filling out these rows that they said the underlying cause of death is hypothyroidism, and I know that's wrong because they said it happened in the 24 hours before death, while all the things before it happened years before death. That's probably just putting it on the wrong line. They meant to say it's another significant contributing condition. But the point is, there's lots of errors in how these things are filled out. It's something that doctors don't always know why they're doing. Are there any doctors here who I'm going to make fun of if I start saying this stuff? It's not making fun of doctors. Actually, this is my chance to say, these things are important. It's so important to public health, to global health metrics, to understand what people are dying of. And I understand it doesn't seem important compared to helping someone who's ill, but we use them.
As an editorial, it can be very challenging to categorize this. I would say mainly in cases where people are elderly and die in their sleep, for example.
Yes.
And you use natural causes, you can take back.
Yes. And in a global context, you will see these where the line A says, act of God, you know, old age, which we call garbage codes, which is probably impolite. And I'm looking for a diplomatic alternative to this term, but so far, this is what we're stuck with. Garbage codes mean the underlying cause written on the death certificate is something that is not acceptable as an underlying cause of death. And it could be because it's completely nonspecific, like act of God. Or it could be because it just doesn't make sense with the other stuff that's on the death certificate. And in the best systems in the world, there's still 10% garbage codes. And in some systems in the world, there's more than 50% of death certificates have an underlying cause of death that we can't use. So one of the major efforts in the Global Burden of Disease 2010 study was coming up with ways to redistribute those garbage codes. And if it says act of God, we have no idea what the cause of death was. It really could be anything. But if it says unspecific neoplasm, unspecific site, then we know it was, we know something. So using that information has been quite an art, which I won't get into in more detail, but I think it's an area where there's room for some careful data-driven analysis to really clean things up, at least for some important causes. Now, the other thing to note about this map is some countries that aren't colored in. Here's a version where it's flipped, and the things that weren't colored in the last map now are colored in to say those red areas filling almost all of Africa are countries where we don't have vital registration data. So we don't know what the causes of death on the death certificates were, regardless of the problems with using them. And what do we do to find out what people are dying of in those places? Well, here, there's an approach called the verbal autopsy, which is something else that I'm very excited about, which is basically an interview. You find someone who has familiarity with the deceased, and you sit them down for half an hour or an hour to go through detailed questions about the signs and symptoms that the deceased had shortly before their death. Did blank have fever during her last illness? How many days and months before the death did the fever start? Or just tell me all of the signs and symptoms in the order that they occurred. Or just tell me in your own words everything that happened. And also for a different talk, this is something that I have been working to automatically go from answers to causes of death, because the sort of standard in the field was to find doctors who could do it, and that takes a long time, and if you think it's hard when you've had some contact with a patient, imagine just reading a secondhand interview and trying to come up with it. And it's also something that we've been working with colleagues in the computer science department to make into an electronic instrument that you could administer on a tablet or cell phone, because this is a complicated survey, and it's hard to go from the survey answers to a diagnosis, but it's even hard just to go from the survey answers to a database. People are always sneaking in new questions on this complicated survey because they think that those are important. And having it in a uniform format is something that's kind of like a simple success. I'm going to get there. Totally on schedule. No problem. So the next box that I want to talk about is morbidity. I've already talked about how people are dying of all causes. I've already talked about how we might be able to figure out what the causes of death are. Now I'm going to talk about the diseases that people aren't dying from. How do we find out descriptive epidemiology, how many people are living with the different diseases? And the approach to this was to recruit a giant collaboration of experts in all different diseases and have them each go out and do systematic reviews, because they know the substantive area, to find all of the relevant descriptive epidemiology, published, and in a lot of cases, unpublished, but out there in some way or another. Now, this is one of those really overwhelming plots that shows the flow of a systematic review, in this case, about anxiety disorder, descriptive epi. So they found 15,000 abstracts that seemed promising, and went through them and screened them out if they weren't epidemiology, if they weren't really about anxiety after all, if they were secondary analysis, and then figure out what kind of anxiety disorders they were looking at, because we were trying to do a kind of comprehensive anxiety disorders, and go through, until at the end, they've come up with 89 studies that report on the prevalence of anxiety disorder, 3 studies on the incidence, and 5 on remission, and 2 on mortality. And then bring that to me, and I was supposed to figure out some way to combine all of that information to come up with an age, sex, country, time specific estimate. This is a picture of the kind of information I got, again on anxiety disorders. So one bar here shows the value that came out of a study. The highest study in their whole list found a population with 30% prevalence of anxiety. That is very high. But that's the highest out of all of the bars on there, so that's the one we're able to look at. And it was very nonspecific in age. They said this is a group of 15 to 94-year-olds who we have found this prevalence in. This little vertical tick through it represents the uncertainty that they reported, because this is a good epi study, and they said, you know, we're not sure it's 30% prevalence. Could be as low as 27% prevalence. Very high prevalence. And my job was to draw a nice line through all of that, putting it together. And I won't go through in detail how I did it, although I would love to. But it's especially complicated because in a lot of cases, dementia, for example, the experts came up with good data on the prevalence of the disease and good data on the incidence of the disease. And these things are connected. You can't have a prevalence case without first have had an incident case. And the incident case stays a prevalent case in this case because there's not remission until death, which they also have data about the relative mortality risk for people with dementia. All of these things is a function of age, because in so many diseases, dementia being a great example, there's huge variation as a function of age, from basically none in age 60 to very high, eyeballing it, you know, somewhere around 50% prevalence in oldest ages. The lines I draw through it look like this. And I have one slide that has, you know, bullet points on the different aspects of this model, but disability weights. I'll get to them. So what this has done is come up with consistent estimates, and it says if the population has these incidence rates, it derives these prevalence rates. If I'm talking to a stats crowd about this, I would say this is nonlinear mixed effects meta-regression. If I'm talking to a different crowd, I could make up my own name for it, and I like to call it integrative systems model. But we'll see if that catches on.
Sorry, I'm not sure what you said.
That's a very honest answer. So I said I have one slide that shows the various parts of this model, and I won't go into great detail about it. But it uses a compartmental model where there's a population that's susceptible to disease, a population that's with the condition, to connect up incidence, prevalence, remission, and mortality. It uses spline models for the variability with respect to age. And then it's really set up in a Bayesian setting so that you can use priors from the expert groups, so that if they say that can't be, and I say, well, you don't have any data on it, they say, no, no, but we know it can't be. Okay, we can put that in some unified way and see what the effects of it are. Any questions about that? Well, then let me tell you a little bit about how we come up with the disability weights. I said I was going to do 4 out of these 18 boxes, and it seems like I will be able to. That's great. To return to where we started, disability adjusted life years are years of life lost plus years lived with disability. And it's years lived with disability that I'm going to focus on now. What are those? Well, they've been more complicated before, but now there's something very simple. They're prevalence times a disability weight. And the disability weight is a conversion factor. It says 1 year of having the sequela of this disease are equal to, well, how many years of life lost. So it's a number between 0 and 1, and if you get everything in the right order, 0 means full health, 1 means you're dead. And this says, for a bunch of different diseases, where on that interval are you? In the original round of global burden of disease, GBD-96, I call it in this slide, could be GBD-90, depending on when you count the start time. The approach was to assemble a panel of experts and have them discuss and come up with their idea of how bad things were. So class 1 are things that aren't too bad. Class 4 are things that are pretty bad, below knee amputation, deafness, for example. Class 7 are things that are sort of the worst sequela of disease, according to these experts. And active psychosis, so schizophrenia is one of the things that was put in that worst area. This is something that was very controversial in the original round of global burden of disease. There's a couple reasons for that. One reason is just about coming up with disability weights. And I think that there the controversy centers on what you're going to do with these things. Some people want to say there's just this number and we use it for anything. But other people say that doesn't make any sense. And if you do it that way, it seems like you're representing me or my friends incorrectly. Other people said, no, this is for a very specific use. We're trying to figure out disease burden and compare diseases. So if you're using it just for that very specific use, I think that diffuses some of the controversy. Some of the other controversy was about how those numbers were assembled to begin with. Having a panel of experts look at a ruler and say it's here is not necessarily representative of the whole world. In our new approach, we have taken what's more like kitten wars as a way to get input from a broad segment of the population about disability weights. Now, if you're not familiar with the Kitten War website, this website gives you a picture of a kitten on the left and a kitten on the right and asks you to click the cutest kitten picture. And this is exactly analogous to the approach taken in GBD 2010 to determine disability weights. In there, it was more like a would you rather question than a cute kitten question. Or to be totally precise, it was actually consider two people who have these conditions. Which one do you think is healthier overall? And we did this as a web-based survey in several languages, and we did this as a face-to-face survey in several countries. So we actually put together a really large data set of people answering these weird questions. And here, this really is a screenshot from when I was taking the survey, the kind of question that it's asking. So if you read through it, on the left, they're probably describing someone who has migraines, when they're having a migraine. And on the right, well, they're describing someone who has chemical dependency of some sort. I'm not sure if this is across the board or this is alcohol dependency, but the idea of these descriptions was to say it's not about the disease, it's not about the stigma related to opioid dependency, you know, except for the hallucinations. This could be my coffee dependency, what they're describing on the right here. But it's about saying, in terms of health overall, which one is worse? And for people who think computers scientifically in the audience, you might say, okay, that'll give me an ordering of these different sequela. But you said you were going to give me a number between 0 and 1. So after you go through 20 of these, then there's a different kind of question that says, last question is going to ask you to compare overall health between two different programs. And now it's really about health programs, programs to improve health. You can do one thing that will prevent 1,000 people from getting an illness that causes rapid death. You can do another thing that will prevent X people, more than 1,000, and that's one of the things that varies in it, 10,000 people from getting an illness that is not fatal but causes, and then plug in one of those lay descriptions, migraines, the sequela of migraines from the last slide. Which one would you say produced greater overall population health benefit? And once you've got answers to those as well, now it's not just relative ordering. Now you can map it with a statistical model to a number between 0 and 1. You can even get uncertainty for those numbers.
Who is the audience that you gave this survey to? Because I can see getting different results from, say, experts in a field versus layperson.
Yeah, good question. So there was a lot of concern going in, or a lot of criticism from the old one, that these things are culturally variable. And one big concern was that if you field this study in the Philippines or you field it in rural Africa, you're going to get very different answers. Another concern is different people have different experience with these things. Doctors might really know how bad this is from watching their patients cope with it, versus people who don't have much experience besides their personal experience with the health system might not be able to imagine how bad they are. And the cultural variability question was the kind of first one that we looked at, and the answer is it doesn't vary that much culture to culture. There's data from the web survey about whether people are health workers, and it's sort of to be done to really dig into that and see what varies. And even culturally, there are some things that vary. So good area for future questions. This slide just shows where the surveys were fielded, how many responses there were. Fair amount. And this is only the second time I've been able to give this part of the talk with actual results. So these slides are some of the ones that say, what did we find from the disability weight survey? First of all, most of the sequelae of disease people judged were not that serious. Some of them they judged were very serious. Compared to what experts found looking at a ruler, there's correlation, for sure. It goes up and to the right. On the other hand, there are some things that the general population thought were much worse than the doctors. There are some things that they thought were not as bad. Migraine, actually that one that you saw the text of, stands out as something that doctors talking together in a room said is no big deal. And something that people reading the text description of said, that is huge. Schizophrenia, which is the worst sequela of disease from this survey, is something that doctors also thought was quite bad when they were talking together. So those were all the boxes. I think this is around the time that I'm supposed to be wrapping up.
I have a quick question, and I'm sorry if it's a stupid question, because global health really isn't my area of expertise, but is there a reason you chose to use DALYs instead of QALYs?
So the answer is complicated.
Okay.
I'm not a super qualified person to answer it. But my understanding is the big difference is whether it's health loss or health gain. And the other answer is there's not that many people in the world who see a clear difference between DALYs and QALYs. So for the experts, yes, there's a very clear answer why we use DALYs, not QALYs. I can't really give it. And for the non-experts, if you're familiar with QALYs, this is the same basic approach as QALYs. Don't worry about the subtle differences. So what comes next? Well, we're going to do it again and again and again and again because people like it so much they want it to be updated annually. And that's the bullet one, GBD up-to-date. Come this December, I want to take all of the problems that people found looking at that tool and fix as many of them as we can, incorporate all the new data that's surfaced because people say, wait a sec, you didn't use the latest and greatest to get the numbers right in my country. Update. Subnational burden. And you looked at that map there, you know, there were a lot of countries on that map that have smaller population than a lot of provinces in China. So it's very important to take some of the biggest countries, start breaking them up so that we can look at a finer grained resolution. And finally, perhaps most exciting next step for this, is matching dollars to burden, to say, how are we spending compared to how are we suffering? How does that match up? And I'll close with this, which doesn't start matching those things, but just shows on the x-axis there's great variability in health spending per capita. And on the y-axis it shows there's great variability in health-adjusted life expectancy, which is life expectancy but using DALYs instead of deaths so that we say how many years of healthy life do people expect at birth. You see the United States furthest out to the right for spending per capita, but nowhere near the top of the healthy life, health of the HALE, health-adjusted life expectancy curve. And Great Britain is called out there having slightly higher health-adjusted life expectancy while spending much less per capita. CHE is Switzerland, which spends almost as much as we do and gets a lot more for it. And Japan is that one that's really called out as something, you know, everyone should try to achieve like that if Japan proves that it's possible. Spend less, get more. So that is the conclusion, and if you have to run off, I understand, and if you want to ask questions, I will stay for them. Thank you.
Level data with reasonable accuracy in Kenya, counties aren't even
choice of units has been ad hoc, I would say, so far. And people wouldn't say it was ad hoc. Are you still recording this? They would say they were chosen in a clustering based on demographic and epidemiological similarity. But I think now that we have all of the data assembled, we can revisit that. And in the approach we took now, countries were clustered into